When you say, do you think they want to? Maybe they want to and maybe they don't, but I think they want to make a deal. I'm not sure they have a choice, and I don't say that as a threat.
Trade optimism amid impending tariffs. It's Tuesday, August 27th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, New Zealand's refugee restrictions. U.S. farmers harvest uncertainty. U.S. foreign aid safe for now. Remembering slavery's roots and trimming powerful hair. It's all on today's VOA Asia. President Donald Trump voiced new optimism that a trade deal could be reached with China to end the tit-for-tat tariff war between the world's two biggest economies. Trump told reporters at the G7 summit in France that China had called top U.S. trade representatives and said, let's get back to the table. But the U.S. leader quickly added, this has to be a deal that's better for us. He again cited the wide trade surplus China has enjoyed for years over the United States, $419 billion more in exports to the United States than in American goods it bought in 2018. He said that the tariffs he has imposed on $250 billion worth of Chinese imports and plans for taxes on another $300 billion worth of goods have hurt China's economy, even as China has imposed levies on $75 billion worth of American exports. China has taken a very hard hit over the last several months, he said. Trump has often praised Chinese President Xi Jinping as his friend and an able leader. On Monday, he continued his praise, but suggested the Chinese leader had been put into a difficult position.
I think President Xi is a great leader who happens to be a brilliant man, and he can't lose 3 million jobs in a very short period of time, and that's going to be magnified many times over, and it's going to break down the Chinese system of trade, and he can't do that. So when you say, do you think they want to? Maybe they want to, and maybe they don't, but I think they want to make a deal. I'm not sure they have a choice. And I don't say that as a threat. I don't think they have a choice. In the meantime, the United States, which has never collected 10 cents from China, will in a fairly short period of time be over $100 billion in tariffs. So I think they want to make a deal very badly.
Not everyone agrees with the U.S. president's stand on the issue. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Jeff Moon. He is a former assistant U.S. trade negotiator for China under U.S. Presidents Reagan through Obama.
I think that we are seeing a real estate salesman negotiate throughout this deal. And he, as he's spent more time in office, he has relied less on his advisors, less on subject matter experts, more on his gut instinct. He is a short-term tactical thinker who tries to gain a win in every conversation and really does not base his policies on long-term principles or a long-term strategic view. And that's why we're seeing him vacillate back and forth and change his mind, because there isn't a long-term consistent principle. I think Hong Kong is the best example of this. At first, when he was asked about Hong Kong, he said that, well, this is something that President Xi can worry about. Then he started talking about how the Chinese need to treat Hong Kong people humanely. And now he's talking about how this could be related to the trade negotiations. You know, if he had just looked back to long-standing U.S. policy dating back to the 1992 Hong Kong Policy Act, he would see that American policy is based on autonomy. We want to encourage the autonomy of Hong Kong. And those principles would serve us very well throughout all of the back and forth that we've been experiencing over the past few months.
What we have heard from President Trump as well is that someone should have taken on China decades ago. He keeps saying that over and over again. And there are those in this country who say, yeah, it's about time.
Well, people did take on China decades ago. The fact of the matter is that anyone who went to China decades ago doesn't recognize China anymore. The circumstances have changed considerably. China was a backward country. We wanted to bring China into the international community, and we did that successfully. It just turns out that China didn't make good on its pledge to become a market economy that participated without discrimination in the international trading system. And so here we are now, and he is right. We do need to challenge those policies of the Chinese right now. But it's not like nobody did anything before.
Well, what is this doing to the economy?
This is a real problem. The thing that businessmen value most is stability and predictability. And based on the events of the last few days, no one can reasonably predict what is going to happen in China, much less what President Trump's policy is going to be. Is he going to force companies to leave China, or should they stay in China? The only comfort that I get out of all of that is that even if he wanted to implement his, quote, order that companies leave China, it would take at least 15 months to implement that. And by that time, we're at the end of his first term. Maybe we have a new president. But this is a huge problem. Companies everywhere really don't know how to invest, how to do business in the future, how to make plans. And this is the time of the year when they're making those plans.
What about the world economy?
The world economy is suffering. The U.S. economy, as President Trump reminds us frequently, is doing rather well. But the European economy is slowing. The Chinese economy is slowing. This tariff war is a drag on growth in all countries, including in the United States. It's not at all helpful. And so we seem to be going down a spiral that I hope we'll be able to end sometime soon. After the Chinese retaliated last week, President Trump decided to increase tariffs. So he now has new tariffs that are going to be imposed on September 1st, October 1st, and then December 15. The problem here is that Trump is ignoring the politics on the Chinese side. It takes two to make a deal, and the Chinese need to be ready. They are not ready. They can make no concessions until October 1st because they're celebrating the 70th anniversary of China. And that the news has to be happy and not include concessions. And also, any concessions will encourage protests in Hong Kong. So Trump is punching a brick wall to the extent that he's going to try to hold the Chinese to tariff deadlines on September 1st and October 1st. Those deadlines are going to pass. The Chinese are going to ignore those deadlines. Nothing will be accomplished. And the only net result is going to be that American consumers are going to pay more in taxes than they would have otherwise, while Trump will have wasted leverage that he could have used in the future. This is a real problem, and Trump needs to start taking into account his negotiating partner, what they can and can't do.
The U.S.-China tariff war has roiled world stock markets for the weeks, and with wild gyrations in market performance, depending on the tariff announcements coming out of Washington and Beijing, and then regaining ground when some hopeful signs surface that the two sides might yet reach a trade agreement in the coming months. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit our website at voanews.com. Trump voices new optimism for a China trade deal. Why Southeast Asian navies will hold exercises with the United States after the same with China. Indonesia to move capital from Jakarta to East Kalimantan. Observers urge social media platforms to keep scrutinizing China-backed accounts. Trump says India's Modi feels he has it under control in Kashmir. Expanded coverage of these stories and more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Human rights advocates have urged lawmakers in New Zealand to drop restrictions on the intake of African and Middle Eastern refugees. Following developments is Phil Mercer in Sydney.
New Zealand's immigration regulations prevent the resettlement of refugees from Africa and the Middle East, unless they already have family members living in the country. The measures were introduced by the previous centre-right government in 2010, due in part to security concerns, as New Zealand focused on facilitating immigration from Asia. Campaigners say the policy is discriminatory and undermines the integrity of a nation that's been praised for its response to deadly mosque attacks in March, when a lone gunman murdered 51 people and wounded dozens more in an attack in the city of Christchurch. Refugees from Syria and Somalia were among the victims. Rights groups have filed a petition on the so-called family link immigration rules for Middle Eastern and African refugees to a parliamentary committee, which is reviewing the measures. Some lawmakers agree the regulations are racist, but New Zealand's Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters told TVNZ the policy is fair.
Well, how do you be racist? Well, how could it be possibly racist when all the ones coming in are brown or black? Because how could that possibly be racist? None of these refugee countries have said that New Zealand is racist. That's why they're queuing up to come here, because we're not.
The current immigration policy doesn't apply to people who apply for asylum in New Zealand, although the isolated South Pacific island nation has few migrants seeking asylum compared to other developed countries. The government in Wellington has announced plans to increase the number of refugees it takes in each year by 500 to 1,500, beginning in the year 2020. New Zealand has a population of about 4.7 million people. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif is visiting Beijing, where he says Iran and China need to join forces to counter unilateralism and contempt for international law. Zarif did not mention the U.S. directly in his remarks, but he appeared to be referencing the Trump administration. You can stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. U.S. farmers currently caught in the middle of a trade dispute between the Trump administration and China are also facing one of the most erratic years of weather variations, leaving many fields unplanted. VOA's Kane Farapaw visits Colfax, Illinois.
Illinois farmer Megan Dwyer's outlook this spring was dire.
We were probably 15% prevent plant that we weren't able to put a cash crop in.
But today, the sun is shining on the crops Dwyer could plant. More than she needs.
We went from too much rain to we hardly got a drop the entire month of July.
We've had a little bit of a flash drought through this area. Here we haven't had 2 inches in a month.
Reed Thompson had better luck this year, getting all of his crops planted in time, despite less than ideal prices.
When we started planting, the corn price went down to $3, $3.20. Beans were almost under $8.
That's down from over $10 just a year ago, a dip Thompson attributes mostly to Chinese tariffs. While weather is the great variable farmers cannot control, the arrival of storm clouds over Thompson's farm is providing temporary relief.
And so we kind of went from nothing to something.
And hope. But the political winds that determine trade policy are blowing even darker clouds over U.S. farmers.
When you're faced with that situation and production risk is becoming real and then your trade opportunities and your buyers are going away, it's very frustrating.
Our farmers are kind of in the dumps right now.
But Illinois Farm Bureau senior economist Mike Doherty says there is a silver lining.
There were purchases just in the last 2 days of soybeans by the Chinese.
But with China's continued threats to boycott U.S. soybeans, a swine flu ravaging China's pig population, which is dependent on soybeans for protein, and erratic weather. Doherty says it's a perfect storm of hardship for American farmers.
No matter where you drive, you run into fields with stunted corn and stunted soybeans, and they cannot possibly yield great if we have an early frost or other things that happen over the course of this year, this crop year, those yields are even going to go down further.
Which is Dwyer's big concern. How much of her planted crops can she salvage before the first frost arrives?
We're still a little nervous on if it's actually going to hit maturity before we see a freeze.
She hopes trade relations with China warms by then. So if the weather doesn't cooperate, a strong market exists for the product farmers are ultimately able to harvest. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Colfax, Illinois.
Coming up, the direction of U.S. foreign aid. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
The This news from VOA Asia, with a draft peace agreement between the United States and the Afghan Taliban circulating after 10 months of negotiations, the insurgent group is pushing a new media campaign, boasting about what it had described as the success of its past strict Islamic rule as it revisits its tenure in power. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for this and much more. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, President Donald Trump has abandoned his fight with Congress over slashing $4 billion in foreign aid and will allow the already appropriated funds to be spent. But the State Department says it agreed with the White House to redirect all funding that does not directly support our priorities. VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more.
President Trump has expressed ambivalence about U.S. foreign aid, calling it wasteful and unnecessary, and considering a proposal to stop funding it.
We give billions and billions of dollars to countries that don't like us even a little bit, and I've been cutting that.
But after both Democratic and Republican lawmakers objected to the White House effort, the Trump administration gave in. Some experts agree with the president that not all U.S. funding that goes towards international organizations and foreign countries is well spent, but they objected to the proposed across-the-board cuts without justification.
But if they hope to actually have that money be used better or reallocated in the future, they need to provide a justification for it, one that's convincing both to the State Department and to USAID, and also to members of Congress.
Other experts and international development organizations welcomed the decision to abandon the cuts as a big win.
It's a big win for, frankly, the United States and its own interests, as I think it was a short-sighted effort to politicize foreign assistance, pegged under the auspices or described as an effort to reduce the deficit, when in fact foreign aid represents less than 1% of the federal budget.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, in public, has strongly agreed with the president that every single dollar of U.S. taxpayer money must be spent carefully to reflect U.S. priorities. But some leaders of the international development community have thanked Pompeo for fighting, behind the scenes, against major cuts to foreign aid.
It's certainly the case, and was the case last year, that Secretary Pompeo was a strong supporter for foreign assistance. Quite frankly, so were the military leaders who spoke forcefully last year in support of continued development or continued funding for development assistance as a critical pillar to our national security.
Under the president's direction, the State Department has frozen U.S. foreign assistance to the Northern Triangle countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, saying those nations are not taking concrete actions to reduce the number of illegal migrants coming to the U.S. border. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia and the VOA family is mourning the loss of Akbar Ayazi, the director of VOA South and Central Asia Division, who passed away Sunday after a prolonged battle with lung cancer, complicated by pneumonia. He was 65. Since 2015, Ayazi was responsible for VOA language services, broadcasting from Turkey to his native Afghanistan. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, in August of 1619, several Africans were brought to Virginia in bondage, beginning more than two centuries of slavery in the United States. 400 years later, scholars at VOA's Town Hall with Norfolk State University take a look at slavery's bitter roots and its lasting impacts on the nation. VOA's Jasusiman Oni reports.
Scholars, state officials, and students in Virginia took part in a town hall commemorating the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the first African slaves in what would become the United States. Panelists at the event, sponsored by VOA and Norfolk State University, reflected on the dark moment in American history.
It's not just African people came to America, they were forcibly brought against their will, and they resisted every step and every moment of every day.
And for the 246 years of slavery that followed, civil rights activists say there should be some form of payment to the descendants of enslaved Africans.
And when we talk about slavery, we can't talk about it just as an evil. That's one thing. but we also have to talk about it as theft. The theft of people's labor.
Reparations doesn't just mean give somebody money. Reparations has to do with an overhaul to right a wrong. So we talk about equality, but we don't talk about equity.
But slavery's bitter roots run deeper than just economically. The years that followed have led to a complex relationship between some African Americans and Africans born outside the states.
For many Africans or Afro-Caribbeans coming to the United States, they may not be fully aware of this history of Jim Crow, et cetera, and how we have come to this point. Likewise, African Americans are not always very familiar with Africans. We don't know languages or customs. Mm-hmm.
And if you're coming into this country without having a sense of how this house was built, we built it. And so I think a lot of African Americans are looking at people from the Caribbean and from Africa and saying, do you not understand the price we paid for you to come into this country as you have and take advantage of what's here?
Many in the audience wanted to know what can be done amid what they see as persistent racial tensions in today's society.
We need to learn how to create legacies for our communities. In my lifetime, racism has never disappeared, so we need to work on building our communities, and you start financially.
Cassandra Newby Alexander, Dean of the Liberal Arts College at Norfolk State University, adds that it's important to place a demand on future leaders.
Their responsibility is to their broader community, that they must leave that door open and ensure that other people follow them who look like them, so that they're no longer at a boardroom and they're the only African Americans in that room. They have to make sure that that room is not just one or two, but at least half, that they are representing many different voices in the community.
Dean Newby Alexander adds, education is the key to changing communities and creating better legacies. Jason Samuel, VOA News, Virginia.
For more than 50 years, a Washington barber has cut hair and has become somewhat of a legend. So much so that his popularity has led him to cut the hair of numerous U.S. presidents and world leaders. Jacques Peluzzi interviewed the man they call the President's Barber.
Presidents Donald Trump, Barack Obama, George Bush and Bill Clinton are a few of the political figures who have been clients of Diego D'Ambrosio. This Sicilian-born barber has cut the hair of more than 46 heads of state since 1968 in Washington. Diego says it's been a privilege to cut the hair of so many important people, but he says every client is important.
Everybody is the same. All of the people that come here, we give it the same.
In 2010, Washington D.C.'s mayor renamed the street where his shop is. Before it was Q Street, now is Diego D'Ambrosio Way. Customers praise not only his handiwork on their hair, but his involvement in the local community.
I've been coming here for almost 40 years, 40, and it's family here. You come here and everybody used to feel like family. Obviously, he's an excellent hairstylist, so he always makes me look good.
Even though Diego has been a barber for decades, and despite some health limitations, he has no intention to quit.
I want to tell you very, very serious. I love this job. I love the people. I like to see the people. I like to serve the people, and the people that serve me because they bring the money in.
No one in his shop knows how old he is. Even the people who work with him are not sure if he will ever retire.
He's the kind of person that nobody knows his age. But I feel see him look almost the same.
So what's Diego's secret?
Nothing you sick or you old. I never think I'm old because I'm young.
Diego plans to keep his doors open, saying the words business close will never exist in his vocabulary. Jacopo Luzzi, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud. You can hear us streaming each and every day on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. You'll also hear us on great radio stations like Chiang Mai University, Radio FM 100 at Chiang Mai University in Thailand. Thanks to everyone there who's tuned in today. Our thanks also go out to our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Nelson Lopes, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Keith Lane. Thanks, too, to Michelle Liu for getting us on Facebook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a great day.